We're going to start off the program with some of the latest politics on Capitol Hill before Congress heads off on recess next week. And the nation is celebrating a big anniversary in civil rights this week. We wanted to talk about these topics and more, so we've called Maria Cardona. She's a Democratic strategist and a principal in the Dewey Square Group, which is a public relations firm, a public affairs firm. She's here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Also joining us, Kevin Williamson, roving correspondent for the National Review. He's with us from our bureau in New York. Kevin, welcome back to you as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
So let me start with you, because you were born and raised in Texas and wrote a book about LBJ. This week marks the 50th anniversary of the passage of the Civil Rights Act. It bans discrimination based on race, religion, sex, or national origin. The law was pushed for and signed by Lyndon B. Johnson. Four presidents are paying tribute to him this week at the LBJ Library. So, Kevin, let me start with you as a native Texan. I wanted to ask, first of all, is Johnson's civil rights legacy something that is kind of part of your DNA as a Texan?
No, I think Lyndon Johnson was a monster, one of the worst people to ever hold the office of the presidency, probably next to Woodrow Wilson. So, just the 50th anniversary of him signing the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It's the 57th anniversary of his gutting the Civil Rights Act of 1957. It's the 64th anniversary of his blocking the Civil Rights Act of 1950. And I forget which anniversary it is of his filibuster of the anti-lynching bills. But, Johnson was an absolute opportunist. From what I am able to put together about him, I'm not sure he could even tell principle from self-interest apart.
But he is a person who went, as you wrote, from blocking these anti-lynching bills to being a civil rights champion in a very short period of time. So,
yeah, a remarkable turnaround. And, you know, he gave a talk to some of his former fellow senators when he was president. And one of the Robert Caro books talks about this, and he gives him this little speech about, you know, these Negroes are getting uppity, but now they've got something they didn't have before, which is political clout. And we have to give them something, not enough to make a difference. And these are LBJ's words, but just a little something.
You think this was just pure opportunism on his part? Is that what you think?
Well, I think his whole career was pure opportunism. And again, I don't think he actually knew the difference between his own political self-interest and the national interest. I think he had a real sense of sympathy, a genuine and authentic sense of sympathy for the downtrodden and the marginalized and the excluded. But I think that manifested itself in him in just, you know, sort of pure political calculation. And he was a genius at that. You know, he was, as they say, the master of the Senate.
Well, Maria, presumably you're about to explode here, so I take it you have a different view.
Yes, very different view. Clearly, LBJ evolved during his political career, as so many politicians do. Now, understanding that Republicans don't really believe in evolution, I can see why they would have a problem with LBJ's evolution. He's being called an opportunist, but I think the bottom line is that he gave the opportunity to millions and millions of voters in this country who did not have the opportunity to really have their voices heard, to have their voices heard. We're talking about African Americans, we're talking about Latinos, we're talking about new Americans, we're talking about everybody who did not have a voice up until then. Say what you want about what he did or said or why he did it before then, there is no question that he changed the course of history by giving millions of people the right to have their voice heard. And that is historic.
And signing a Republican civil rights bill, incidentally. But, you know, what happens to a man when he's that age and that far along in life? He's already been vice president and all the rest of it. And over the course of 7 years, which is a relatively short period of time, he goes from being a guy who is, you know, gutting the Eisenhower civil rights bill, taking all the significant stuff out of it, specifically removing the enforcement provisions, to being the guy who says this is going to be my cornerstone. Mm-hmm. And he says he's going to do it, you know, as a tribute to John Kennedy. Well, John Kennedy voted against the Civil Rights Act in 1957.
How do you think you want to remember his legacy? I mean, I also want to mention, look, during his years, America also saw the creation of Medicare and Medicaid, consumer protection laws, environmental protection laws, immigration.
Disaster fight after disaster poverty. After disaster.
Well, but how do you want to remember his legacy? I
think how we should remember LBJ's legacy is as honestly as we can, which is that, you know, he was a guy who came into office on the strength of the New Deal. And, you know, you talked about me being from Texas. I grew up not far from a town called New Deal, Texas. The New Deal was extraordinarily popular in Texas. And Johnson's Political strategy was to try to recreate that in the 1960s with a new set of programs of which the civil rights bills were part of and the war on poverty stuff was also a part of. But they were mostly not very good programs. You know, I think, unlike a lot of my fellow libertarian-minded people, that something had to probably be done at the national level in 1964. Just the situation of African Americans was not a socially or politically sustainable thing, and waiting for civil society to act on that was not going to be really the way to go. But we declared war on poverty at a time which the poverty rate had been collapsing for 20 years. And then that reduction there about froze in the few years after that and has been going up since. Mm-hmm. You know, we've spent a little over $1 trillion on the so-called war on poverty, and the poverty rate's the same now as it was in 1964.
But let me give Maria a chance to respond. How do you want to remember his legacy?
I think that we should remember his legacy the way that President Bill Clinton is remembering it this week, which is to focus on the fact that, again, say what you will about how he got there, he got to a place that was right for this country, that was, you know, it's interesting that Kevin says that it was a Republican civil rights bill. What's so interesting about the backwards evolution that Republicans have gotten to is that today we're celebrating 50 years of the civil rights bill, the Civil Rights Act, and today in Republican legislatures all across the country, we are seeing laws that are being passed that are actually trying to take away that right from so many minority voters. So those Republicans are clearly going in the wrong direction.
With the terrible onerous restriction that people do to vote, what they have to do to get on an airplane or go to the bank or walk into a government building, which is show a photo ID.
And
I mean, if you're really going to compare Republicans that to Jim Crow, this is nonsensical.
Republicans love to say that, but exhibition. You know what, Kevin? Not everybody in this country has the privilege of walking onto an airplane. Not everybody in this country can even show a birth certificate or have a photo ID. It costs money. It has resources. If you have grown up in a group home without parents, you do not have a photo ID. You don't necessarily have the means
every
to even get
every state that has introduced a voter ID bill has included a provision
ID
to get them for free.
All right, let's just take one moment here to let people know what we're doing here. And if you're just joining us, we're having our political chat with Democratic strategist Maria Cardona and the National Review roving correspondent Kevin Williamson. We were talking about the legacy of LBJ. And since we're in a moment of remembrance, Maria, do you mind if I take a moment to acknowledge the late Secretary of Commerce, Ron Brown? He died on April 3rd, 1996, in a plane crash during a trade mission to Croatia that took the lives of Secretary Brown, 34 business, military, and government officials, including 11 employees from Congress. You were a deputy press secretary at Commerce. So I just wanted to take a moment to say so sorry for your loss and the loss to the country.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
But another reason I'm acknowledging this is that that kind of ascension of political leadership is something that people do attribute in part mm-hmm. to the civil rights movement, Secretary Brown, and now more recently, Democratic Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey, mm-hmm. Republican Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, Republican. And on Wednesday, they joined forces for the first time mm-hmm. to unveil their proposed LEAP Act, which stands for Leveraging and Energizing America's Apprenticeship Programs. Hate these bill titles. Just hate them. But what it would do is give tax credit to employers who offer apprenticeships. So, Maria, I just wanted to ask what you make of this kind of, some people might think, a bit of an odd couple, bipartisan odd couple.
I think it's terrific. I think it actually shows that in this era of tremendous polarization in our politics, that when two leaders come together to really focus on trying to get something done, to focus on solutions, put politics aside, focus on the needs of the nation, we can get something done. And this bill is actually something that would help to introduce more opportunity within the high-tech sectors, which we really need, and frankly, more opportunity from, again, communities of color who have been left out of so many of the opportunity vehicles in this country. So I applaud them, and I think it's proof that we can actually do something in Washington.
Kevin, I'm interested, because one of the reasons that I'm interested in Tim Scott's role in this is that he has declined to join the Congressional Black Caucus, saying that he thinks it's divisive, and so it's interesting to me that he is, I mean, and Black Republicans who've served in the Congress and generally have joined, so it's interesting that maybe it's generational on his part, but I'm interested in your perspective on this as well.
Yeah, well, I have no idea why he would or wouldn't join the Congressional Black Caucus. I sort of, you know, and like a lot of conservatives, am uncomfortable with these sort of, you know, racial groupings, and I think they're basically unhealthy. But yeah, I mean, I'm not a huge Cory Booker fan for a lot of reasons, but I think it's a very sensible piece of legislation. I hope it works. I mean, of course, it's a federal program, so it won't, but it's well-intentioned.
Yeah, that should cheer you, should warm your heart.
Yeah, no? I'm not that big on tax credits, actually. Mm-hmm. But, You know, the idea that we really only have sort of one model of education, which is all oriented towards sending people into four-year college degrees and liberal arts and getting office jobs and that sort of thing, I think is intensely destructive. And there are a lot of people who, never mind the question of capacity, just don't have the inclination to have those sorts of jobs. They don't want to work in an office. They want to do other sorts of things. And if we can get them into apprenticeship programs, if we can get them into other sorts of career paths that give them a viable way forward from the time they're fairly young, then I think that's going to be tremendously useful. And I do think, if I could just add one thing, since we're talking about civil rights, it is worth noting that, you know, in Philadelphia, where I lived and worked for a long time, this was a huge issue in the city council there because the Philadelphia trade unions, of course, are one of the few remaining basically segregated important entities in American public life.
The final thing I wanted to get to, we really don't have time to have a deep discussion about it, is this whole question of pay equity. Democrats pushing for legislation that would, they say, would close the gender wage gap. Republicans in the Senate shot down this Paycheck Fairness Act. Pretty strong words. We don't have time to sort of play them, but you all know what they said. Kevin, very briefly, good call or bad call for the Republicans? Because the Democrats are clearly pushing this hard as a way in part to attract working women, and presumably they think they're right. So,
well, the whole point of introducing bills like this is making Republicans vote against them. It's a nonsense issue. The 77 cents thing is a long discredited figure. It has nothing to do with how businesses actually make decisions about compensation. It has to do with the choices people make about careers.
So you think
careers.
They're right?
Well, I think they're right to shoot it down. I think it's a political loser for them, but that's the whole point of putting these things up.
Okay. Maria, final thought from you?
If Republicans think that the 77 cents or the pay inequity is a myth, then just ask Lilly Ledbetter, who frankly was she missed out on more than $230,000 throughout her lifetime. The Supreme Court agreed with her. As a Democratic strategist, I hope Republicans continue down that line. Okay. As a woman, it is absolutely offensive.
Maria Cardona is a Democratic strategist, principal of the Dewey Square Group. Kevin Williamson is roving correspondent for the National Review. Maria here in Washington, Kevin in New York. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
You bet.
Just ahead, it's bad enough if someone you barely know says something like this.
I've been told that I don't act, sound, dress like a black person.
But what do you do if the accidental offender is your boss? We'll have more on microaggressions, how to handle them in the workplace. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We've been talking about civil rights this week. Earlier this hour, we talked about the legacy of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And yesterday, we remembered Marian Anderson's historic concert at the Lincoln Memorial. And recently, we learned more about the Mexican-American civil rights icon, Cesar Chavez, who helped to organize farm workers in California. There's a new film out about him. So now we're finding out that the story of the Filipino farm workers who stood with Chavez and other Mexican-American activists also deserves more attention. These men, and they were mostly men, single men, had come to the United States in the 20s and 30s looking for better lives. Their story is being told in a new documentary produced and directed by Marisa Arroy. It is called The Delano Manongs, Forgotten Heroes of the United Farm Workers. And Marisa Arroy is with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
So we mentioned that a lot of people are familiar or becoming more familiar with Cesar Chavez and his involvement with the United Farm Workers, but it seems that a lot fewer people know about Larry Itliong, who was second in command at the United Farm Workers. Why do you think that is? Was it just that his public profile was never as high during the course of the movement? Or?
His public profile was definitely not as high as it was, as Cesar Chavez's was. He did talk a lot in public, but it's not as well recorded as it was for Cesar Chavez.
But thankfully, for the film, you have recordings of him talking. I just want to play a clip from your documentary, and here it is.
I'm going to be very frank with you. I have all kinds of guts, you know. I'm not scared of nobody. And I'm a son of a in terms of fighting for the rights of Filipinos in this country.
Now, one of the things that I think people are learning from the new film out about Cesar Chavez is that he tended to mention Martin Luther King Jr. He was very much a part of the nonviolent school of protest. Was Larry Itliong, did he have a different approach?
He certainly had a different approach from Cesar Chavez. He grew up in the school of hard knocks, and he would put it that way as well. Coming in here to the U.S., he was a part of really hard unions. I mean, AFL-CIO was the sponsor for his organizing group in Delano, California. And so it was hard tactics, and it was beating up people who would dare cross the picket line, and it was getting a lot of violence and inflicting violence. And so he actually had to learn from Cesar Chavez how to be nonviolent and to see how that would attract a bigger movement of people.
Do you think that it's in part also the demographics of who the farm workers were? We mentioned earlier that many of the Filipino farm workers came here as single men, whereas the Mexican Americans, because they were probably closer by, oftentimes were coming in as families. And so maybe is it that sort of the attention was focused on them because they were more, what's the word I'm looking at, sort of palatable, like kind of camera ready in a way, that did, kind of more sympathetic as the kind of the public face of the movement? Do you think that might have been part of it?
Oh, certainly. But also the Filipino men were older by the 1960s. So I don't know if you would see them in the forefront of the strikes. I mean, you have a couple of pieces here and there of film clips where you see them singing or you see them talking in Tagalog or Visayan or Ilocano in the fields to their fellow farm workers who are not picketing or not on their side. But the majority of the farm workers were Mexican. And so you just don't see as much talk about the Filipinos. Although people in the movement, Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, any of the activists who were there at the time, have a lot of love for the Manongs. Dolores Huerta's daughter talks about how her mother was always off having to do organizing somewhere in California or outside of the country, and the Manongs were the ones who took care of her. So she feels a lot of affection for them. They were like the older uncles of the movement, and so they were taken care of by the UFW.
What was the role of the Filipino farm workers in the movement, though? As I understand it, they were actually the first to go on strike.
Yes. Their role was that they had wanted a few cents more per box of grapes. And it was as simple as that. They were older men. They wanted retirement money. They wanted to be able to have a comfortable life after being in the fields for decades. They were really the ones who wanted this hardline strike. Mm-hmm. And when the Mexicans joined in with them, when the NFWA joined in with them, it became more of a movement of people.
The Cesar Chavez film makes reference to an attempt to divide and conquer, as it were, to kind of pit the Filipinos against the Mexicans in order to divide the movement. Did that really happen?
Certainly. That's something that the farmers had used for decades, trying to pit the different ethnic groups from each other. It happened in Hawaii for the sugarcane plantations and the workers there, and it happened in California with all the different ethnic groups. You offer a little bit more to this group. Say you offer more money to the Mexicans, and you're fighting with the Filipinos because you want them to lower their prices. So you're certainly trying to pit the groups against each other so that farmers can save money.
What was Larry Itliong's role in this?
Well, in Delano, California, it had a different dynamic because you had Mexicans and Filipinos who were friends. And you had people like Larry Itliong and Dolores Huerta who were friends from Stockton, from their organizing days there. Both came down to Delano to do organizing in different groups. But they knew each other from a previous time organizing together. So you couldn't have one group doing something without the other group knowing as well. And they were talking to each other. They were socializing. My grandfather had a bar in Delano, California, and Richard Chavez, Cesar Chavez's brother, talks about shining the shoes of my grandfather and how my grandfather would tip him money. And it was just a small town. So you get small town communication. Everybody knows what everyone else is doing.
So finally, Marisa, how would you like Larry Itliong to be remembered and the other Filipino farm workers who were part of this movement?
Well, I think all of us need heroes. I didn't grow up with any of this history. To me, it's so important for me to know that we have this base. We've had a voice in the past. And I think every group needs that in order to feel like they can aspire to speaking up and to bringing our community together.
Marisa Arroy is director of the new documentary, The Delano Manongs, Forgotten Heroes of the United Farm Workers. The film is on the festival circuit now and is scheduled to air on PBS next year. She was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Marisa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle, for having me.
Now I'd like to return to something we talked about recently, microaggressions. Now, you might not know that word, but you probably feel it if one is directed at you. These are those little everyday comments or questions or actions that tend to indicate a subtle form of bias. Somebody says, you know, you're awfully pretty for a lesbian. You speak so well for a black person. Or somebody asks you for tech tips because you're Asian American. Well, we got so many responses on Facebook and Twitter last week when we did a shout out asking for examples of this that we decided we had to return to the issue. But this time we decided to focus on microaggressions in the workplace. Darryl Tsu is back with us to tell us more about it. He's a professor of psychology and education at Columbia University Teachers College. He wrote the book Microaggressions in Everyday Life, Race, Gender, and Sexual Orientation, with us from our bureau in New York. Professor Tsu, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Well, thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Luke Visconti. He's the founder and CEO of Diversity Inc., and he writes a column called Ask the White Guy for Diversity Inc. magazine. He's with us from his offices in Princeton, New Jersey. Luke Visconti, it's been a while, but thank you so much for joining us once again.
Hi, thanks for having me on again, Michelle.
So as we mentioned, last week we asked listeners to share some of their experiences with microaggressions, and I want to share one of those stories, this one from listener Ty, who lives in Springfield, Ohio.
All of my life, basically, I've been told that I don't act, sound, dress like a black person. You know, I'm 28 now, and I still hear it constantly. My response is always, well, how are black people supposed to act? Please tell me.
Well, Professor, you know, she made it clear that she doesn't just hear this from white people. She does also hear this from African Americans. So tell me a little bit about what do you think is going on here when somebody says something like that?
Well, what's going on here is that people have a preconceived notion or stereotype that generally is negative about African Americans, Asian Americans, Latino, Hispanic Americans, and they, when you act differently from the negative image that they have of you, they show shock, surprise, and oftentimes they'll say something like, you speak good English, and it's meant as a compliment, but in some sense it undermines your racial ethnic identity by saying that you're a perpetual alien in your own country, you're not very bright or intelligent, and you represent the exception.
So, Luke, you founded a company that focuses on encouraging diversity in the business world. So let's say somebody says this to you and you're in a job interview. I mean, it's one thing if you're a student and somebody says this to you in class, you can say, what do you mean by that? Or what are you trying to say? Or you can, you know, do whatever. But let's say you hear this in a sticky work situation. What do you say? What do you recommend?
Well, especially if you're in a job interview, if you've done your preparation and looked at the company's website and looked for the CEO's comments on diversity, and they should be there, and if they're not, that's a signal. If you're in a job interview, you might be able to write it off as poor behavior on one individual person's, not the company's way of doing things. But if you're in the job and you're hearing this from a supervisor, that's something that you then have to make a decision. Do you take the person aside and gently kind of coach them a little bit about why that wouldn't sound the way they thought it would sound?
Professor Tsu, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, how you deal with it depends a lot in terms of the power differential and the consequences. When we studied, people of color dealing with racial microaggressions, what we found was over 50% of them chose to ignore or do nothing about it because of the fear and consequences that they would not get the job, would not get the promotion. There is something that we've been teaching people of color about how to handle this in a very subtle, indirect way. Let me give you an example. When I'm complimented for speaking good English, what is generally being communicated to me is that I am a perpetual alien in my own country. I'm not a true American. I used to get very upset about that, but the way I undermine that message is to simply say, thank you, I hope so, I was born here. What I am doing is to acknowledge that they perceive on a conscious level that it's a compliment, but I undermine the meta hidden communication, and I try to plant a seed that hopefully will make sense to them later on.
Look, here's something we heard from listener Diego in Knoxville, Tennessee, and this is a classic. I mean, this is something you've written about many times in your column. And Diego says, people often ask me where I'm from. And the natural response for me is to say, New York. And I'm always asked right after, okay, but where are you from? Or people will roll their eyes and say, but where are you from? Okay, so what's going on here, Luke? And tell me, how do you recommend that people deal with this?
I think this is a very important thing. It goes along with what the professor is saying, that the person who's asking that question and insistent on it is usually trying to isolate a person. And I think the professor's words, make them an alien in their own country, are very correct. I get this question in places, where are you from? And I will say the most local thing, Princeton. I'm from New Jersey. And let the person ask two or three times more. Sometimes it's an innocent question. More often than not, it's flowing from a position of perceived superior power to a position of perceived inferior power. And it's a way of putting somebody down, dismissing them, putting them in their place, making them appear small, putting them at ease. It's not correct behavior.
Well, I think some people might say, I'm just trying to figure out if we know anybody in common.
That's usually spoken in a different way, and you could usually tell the difference. I am an optimist, but most of those questions I don't find to be positive.
So what do you do, particularly if the person asking it, let's say you're new at a workplace, which is the kind of the situation in which that's likely to occur, or the person asking you, this is somebody of a higher rank, what do you do? What do you recommend?
Well, I think like the professor said, you at times have to roll with this, and it's uncomfortable, but you can ask the question back, I think, in a way that is not offensive, to helpfully make that person think a little bit about the question that they're asking. I wrote a column about this where I was asked this question by a person who clearly didn't think I belonged in the room, and I kept deflecting it until she finally burst out and told me about how her family had been in Princeton since the settlers. And so she was just really communicating that I didn't belong here, I wasn't part of the club, and she wanted to let me know that.
Well, Michelle, go ahead, Professor Sue.
Yeah, if I can say something that really is important for us to look at, a lot of times what we're saying is that how can people of color, how can women employees in the workplace handle microaggressions? And it's almost like we put the onus of responsibility for any change upon them when it is the decision makers, the organizations with their bias policies, practices, and structures that are causing the harm. So the question I would ask generally is that what are the obligations, what are the responsibilities of the decision makers and the businesses and industry in terms of altering and changing the climate so that microaggressions do not occur?
I think that's nice because you've already got the job, and if you're the boss, so if you're the one you're trying to, I think we're trying to sort of help people who are not yet in a position where they feel like they have that power. Point taken. Take your point entirely, but then again, like a lot of people are in vulnerable positions in the workplace right now, and we want to give them some tools.
They really have to find support groups with one another. Otherwise, they feel that they're isolated, alienated, lonely in the situation. They've got to really find people who understand what I call the minority experience, what it is like to constantly face this constant onslaught of microaggressions that derogate and denigrate and assail their racial ethnic identities.
I'm going to end with a comment from Sean in San Diego. Sean is transgender and gets a lot of personal questions from acquaintances. And he writes, if it's a coworker who didn't know before, if it's somebody that a friend introduced me to or something, if they start asking me questions that I don't think are appropriate to answer, I will call them out and say, look, that's not something you'd ask somebody else, or I will ask them a personal question in response. So that's Sean's word of wisdom. So thank you both so much for telling us more about this important issue. Luke Visconti is the founder and CEO of Diversity, Inc. He's author of the column Ask the White Guy. Daryl Tsu is author of the book Microaggressions in Everyday Life, Race, Gender, and Sexual Orientation. He joined us from our bureau in New York. Thanks both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Coming up, the National Hispanic University is the first and only accredited college in the U.S. focused on educating Latino men and women. But by next year, it will be closed.
What we can do is find a way to make sure that all the time that has been invested is worth something
We'll try to understand the history of this unique institution and what went wrong. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. This spring, we've been focusing on the challenge of paying for college, something that can be especially difficult for families of color or first-generation college students. Now, one institution that was intended to serve one group of students who've often been shut out of college is closing its doors. The National Hispanic University was founded in 1981. It was later absorbed by a private college chain. It had the goal of doing for Latino students what the historically black colleges and universities have done for African Americans, which is to provide a culturally sensitive environment in which to excel. But several weeks ago, the school announced it will close its campus in San Jose, California, in the summer of 2015. The move stunned faculty members and about 600 students currently enrolled there. Joe Rodriguez reported on this for the San Jose Mercury News, and he's with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
So as we mentioned, a lot of people probably have heard about HBCUs in part because there are a lot of them, and they've been around for more than a century. They were founded during a time of kind of legal, explicit, and often violently enforced segregation when blacks couldn't go to other institutions. But I don't know that the National Hispanic University was ever as well known, at least in other parts of the country. So could you just tell us a little bit more about what the idea was at its founding?
Okay, the idea of its founding in 1981, it started in Oakland, was to, as you said, establish a Hispanic university that would be culturally sensitive and at the same time accept students who were not expected to go to college. It would be a college that would take extra care with its freshmen and make sure that they moved on to their sophomore and junior years. It moved in 1990 to San Jose, partly to take advantage of the money here in Silicon Valley. And the school began to offer classes in business, computer science, and mathematics, I think at the expense of degree programs in Spanish and Mexican-American studies. So when it moved to San Jose, it started to change its mission and its funding sources. And I think along the way, always wanted to be that culturally sensitive university, but had to look for funding, and the money here is based on technology. So they started to offer more technological courses. We sort of tried to be too many things.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, but we spoke with Alejandra Valle. Alejandra Valladares. She is a junior there. She's a student leader. And she says her classmates are confused, and it sounds like they were pretty surprised. I just want to play a short clip from our conversation.
Some are angry. Some are saddened by the situation. They come to me with complete, you know, trust and hopes that there could be some type of solution. A lot of them are like, is there any way that we can save the university? Is there any way that we can do something about what we currently find ourselves in? And it's unfortunate to tell them that no.
Is it a shock? I mean, is it the kind of thing that the problems there, the financial problems, were ones that seem to have appeared suddenly? Joe?
Oh, this is for me.
Yes.
The university tried to, when it sold itself to Laureate, the for-profit college chain, thought that that the money would come through online registration, and it eventually did not. The students like Valladares that I spoke to felt betrayed. Those were the students who wanted that intimate classroom environment at NHU. They weren't really sold on the online vision of the university. They were there for the smaller classes, the tutoring that was available to them, and that very, very friendly bilingual, bicultural campus atmosphere.
One of the things, go ahead, I'm sorry, I just wanted to ask, because we only have a couple of minutes left, is that I mentioned that a lot of the HBCUs were founded more than a century ago at a time when blacks could not go to other institutions.
Right.
And that's one reason why segregationists supported them sometimes. I mean, like, for example, the former South Carolina Senator Strom Thurmond, because he didn't want blacks in other institutions. Now, this university being founded in 1981, I wonder if that kind of changed the dynamic of how what appeal it had for students who at that point, maybe they didn't feel particularly welcome on these campuses, but they certainly were free to go. Do you think that that's part of it?
Right. I mean, the student pool was much smaller for the Latino National Hispanic University, simply because the state universities in California especially had already opened their doors to Latino students. And if you were, you know, a good student in high school in California, you had the option of going to a place like San Jose State University. And if you were a student who wanted a big campus and all the things that it offered, you know, sports and laboratories and even planetariums, you were able to go to a state university. NHU was trying to carve out this niche serving students who weren't steered onto the college track. They made an extra effort to find those students in high school, but they were limited to the students here in San Jose. So I do think that the timing was off for NHU. I think they tried to carve out that niche, and it just didn't work. And plus, they couldn't find enough investors here in Silicon Valley. And one group that didn't come through were Latino philanthropists. They just didn't contribute to this university as others might have at another time.
Well, thank you. It's an important story. Obviously, there's a lot of sadness around this. And so thank you so much for reporting on this for us. Joe Rodriguez is a reporter at the San Jose Mercury News who's been reporting on this story. And he joined us from San Jose, California. Joe, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Finally today, you know we like to keep you up to date on the latest pop culture trends, so we want to tell you about a show that just might become your latest guilty pleasure. Take a group of accomplished young women, all friends, making their way through young adulthood, throw in fabulous clothes, great-looking hair, mix in the twists and turns of dating life, and put it on a game-changing platform, and what do you have? Sex in the City? No, it's an African city.
Welcome home. The African continent finally has you back, and just in time for the holidays.
How was your flight?
It was good. Flight was good.
And how does it feel to be back?
It is exciting, and it is scary at the same time. It's scary because I don't know how I'm going to survive without Starbucks coffee. But I'm all smiles for now.
Well, instead of Starbucks coffee, on every corner you'll find plenty of fried plantain.
That's a clip from the new web-based series, An African City. It follows a young woman, Nana Yah, who's just returned to Ghana and her four friends. And by telling hard truths and hilarious stories about life in Ghana now, it's winning fans from Atlanta to Accra. We wanted to learn more, so we've called executive producer Millie Manyo. Also with us is actress Nana Mensah, who plays Shade, a Ghanaian-Nigerian who's just moved back to Ghana from abroad. Welcome to you both. Congratulations.
Hello.
Thank you.
Hi.
So, Millie, I'll start with you. The Sex and the City comparison has got to be made, just in terms of women getting together, telling their business, telling some real deal, even if people don't want to hear it, and fabulous clothes. So was that show an inspiration?
It was absolutely an inspiration. And honestly, we welcome the Sex and the City comparisons. So I know that Nicole Amatafio, the co-creator of the show, was inspired by Sex and the City heavily. These are the stories of these women who are dynamic, running around New York City, and why can't we have that in Africa? Why can't we have that on our continent? Why can't we have that in Ghana and Accra? That's why she sat down and started writing, and she just knew that we could tell our story in this way.
So let me just play a clip from one of the opening scenes that shows one of the characters arriving at the airport. She's going home.
Hello.
Madam, the line for the non-Ghanaians is at the other side.
Yeah, I know. I'm Ghanaian.
Huh? You're a Ghanaian. You don't look, sound like a Ghanaian.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Sting, sting. So tell us about the idea of focusing on the born here, live there, back and forth generation, if you want to call it that.
Well, we definitely wanted to tell the story of the returnee. We wanted to stay true to form. Nicole's a returnee. I'm a returnee. Most of our cast are returnees. And we felt that there was a story that was there where you feel at home in America, but when you come back to Africa, which is your home continent, you have people who look at you and say, well, you're not African enough. And we weren't really sure how to respond to something like that. That has happened to all of us, where we show up and we try to speak our language and they're looking at us like, you Akata, which is, I guess, a slang word for someone who is African. However, you were raised in the West and you may not necessarily know how to navigate life in Ghana anymore.
So, Nana, tell us a little bit about your character.
My character is Shade. She is Ghanaian and Nigerian, which is great. It's a great setup. I don't even know if Nicole did it on purpose because Ghana and Nigeria have such a rivalry, like a big sister, little sister kind of thing. So it's really funny to see it embodied in one character. So she kind of has this Ghanaian thing and Nigerian thing. She graduated from Harvard Business School and she's now returned to work for a pharmaceutical company in Accra. So she's, you know, highly educated, very ambitious, and she set her sights on Accra and the men of Accra to succeed by any means necessary.
Well, one of the things that struck me about it is that it tells, you know, some real stories about how women are getting along. I mean, the women are very upfront about some of their various strategies for success, you know, as it were, or just trying to navigate their lives. I mean, getting an apartment when apartments are priced in a crazy fashion and like a person just on a regular salary couldn't possibly afford one. So how does that happen? Now, Nana, your character Sade is very kind of open about her relationships with married men.
She is.
What's her deal? Tell a little bit about her deal. What's her point of view on all this?
Sade and men, where to begin? It must be known that she is the daughter of the most prominent Nigerian pastor in Lagos. So that just put that at the back of your mind as things develop this season and in subsequent seasons. So that's the one thing. She comes from a very religious background and has rebelled against it. And, you know, she's highly intellectual, very well educated, and very capable of achieving things by her own means. But it's not as much fun to pay for it when you could get somebody else to pay for it, I think is how Sade feels. And so she does, you know, her apartment, her Mercedes, her this, her that. You know, she does kind of have a, you should buy it for me. Why buy it for myself?
But this is not free. And I just want to play another clip if it's okay. I just, you know, spoiler alert, but you're telling us that one of your favorite scenes is one where she shows some vulnerability after she runs into her sugar daddy. And
of course.
Here's a clip.
Who was that man at the salon?
It was him. It's the guy that bought my new apartment. My new home.
And who was that woman?
I don't know.
Are you okay?
Yeah. At the end of the day, I got my apartment, right? You know, it's wonderful until it's not. It's wonderful until you run into them in public and you're hit in the face with the truth that you've been avoiding all along. That you're one of many and you should be somebody's one and only.
Wah, wah.
Aww.
Well,
you know, what about it? I mean, is this the life that a lot of people are living?
So, definitely, you know. Definitely. And that's something that we actually saw firsthand, Nicole and I, being returnees and coming back to Ghana. We'd meet men, numerous men, married men who would be out in public with their wives. However, when they would see us out in other avenues, would approach us and say, you know, let's go out. Let's go out to eat. Let's do things. And it's kind of like, well, are we supposed to be the non-public wife in the background? Kind of playing a role and you just want to give me things and I'm just supposed to take them, and that's not what anyone's looking for.
Well, you know, Millie, one of the things about the show that's really interesting, that I'll just be frank with you, I don't think Sex and the City did all too well, is explaining the power dynamics that come with money.
Sure.
And what role money plays. I mean, one of the points that I think critics of Sex and the City always made is that, you know, a freelance writer for like a weekly newspaper could not afford her life.
those shoes.
So she could not afford her life in the real world, and that somebody had to be paying for that. So who is that somebody? And so this show is very explicit about those things. And I'm just interested in that as kind of an artistic choice, Millie. You know, like just laying it out there. Look, this is how things are right now.
I think it needs to be put out there. You need to know that it's a struggle out there for women alike. You know, how are they paying for these expensive apartments? How are they dressing in the latest fashion? Who's buying it for them? I mean, you see a scene where actually Sade convinces Nanaya to get a sugar daddy. And finally, by the end of the episode, she decides that she's going to go to Ghana Home Loans and, you know, take out a loan and get her apartment on her own because she realizes that she wants to do this for herself.
So what reaction are you all getting to the series? What are folks saying about it?
I think a lot of people have a hard time with the explicit nature of the transactional behavior between men and women. I think that is stirring the pot a little bit. And so I'm interested in some of the pushback from that, because I don't think that anything that we're depicting isn't true. That's been interesting.
How so? I mean, are people basically saying you all are making it up, or that you're being trashy, or what is it? What is it that people are saying?
Well, Millie pays attention to the comments a bit more than I do. So
Millie?
I'll let her take that one.
Millie?
I think that some people may think that it's a bit taboo to actually put it out there. Even though it's happening every day on a day-to-day basis, they don't want to see it. However, I would say that most of our feedback has been enormously positive. There's tons of people who are telling us that, you know, we're showing a different view of Africa that for some people they say they didn't even know existed.
That's
they
true.
Didn't realize that there's people in Africa spending money who have money, you know, or have the means to do these kind of things. They're not realizing that there's places to eat out, there's places to go and entertain yourself. And I mean, they just
and
don't even realize
clothes.
That.
Lots of fabulous clothes.
Exactly. They, you know, people have no idea that this actually exists on the continent. And that's what we really want to show. So we've been getting a tremendously positive response from a lot of our female viewers.
Can you give us some hints about season two?
I would say that we're definitely going in deeper. One of the criticisms that I've heard is that they feel like they don't know the girls very well yet. And I think that subsequent seasons is going to aim to fix that.
Exactly.
To really create a bond between the audience and the individual characters.
Exactly. I think it takes time to grow.
All right. Well, we'll be waiting. We will be waiting to see. Millie Monyo is the executive producer of the web series An African City. Actress Nana Mensah plays Sade on the show. They were kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York City. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.